Welcome to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast. My name's Dr. Andrew Tresidder from Somerset Clinical Commissioning Group, and I'm joined by my friend and colleague,
Peter Bagshaw, GP and Somerset Mental Health Lead.
And we're really pleased today to be talking about veterans' health and wellbeing. And it's great to welcome James Leeson, who works at Yeovil Hospital. And I believe you're a veteran serving, James, in the...
I am, yes. James, I've veteran of 28 years in the Royal Navy. I've been outside now for just over 5 years, but working in Yeovil Hospital in the infection control and tissue viability team as the administrator.
Well, that's great. Well, thinking about veterans' health and wellbeing, let's just take you back to your time serving. Tell us what a veteran is, and tell us about health and wellbeing in the services, please.
A veteran nowadays is very much anyone who served, regardless of how long they've actually served, and that they could have done a few years and left. They could have done a certain number more years and been medically discharged, or like myself, done over a lot of time and got to pensionable age and left the service. So there's different sort of anecdotes to what, or sorry, areas to what a veteran is, and that to where it used to be, where a veteran was someone who'd served in a conflict or had done their sort of pensionable time and that. So, like I said, I've been out for 5 years now, and the wellbeing for servicemen and that has sort of improved very much so. It's always been sort of times during the week where you would have sort of sports, make amends as they referred to, and other times where you'd have get-togethers and meetings and that. But now it's understanding, sort of staying in contact with old friends and that, that mental well-being of service persons, and that is quite high up on the agenda.
And can I ask, James, what attracted you to go into the Navy in the first place, and what were the highs and lows of your time there?
It's quite a strange one, actually, because we're going back to 1987, so we're looking at sort of 5 years after the Falklands and that, so it's still quite fresh in a lot of people's minds. And I was sort of, at the time, sort of deciding what I wanted to do, and originally I was going to join the Merchant Navy. And the services came to the school I was at, the Army, RAF and Navy, and the Navy showed a video, and I was like, this is something, you know, I'm going to have a look at. So I was 14, I think, or something, or coming up for 15. I got my parents to take me over to the careers office, and they said, look, you have to come back in about a year, and that you're a bit too young at the moment. So I went back the following year, and then 6 months later, sort of packed my bag and got on the train down to Plymouth and joined the services. There's always good times in that when you're with your friends and colleagues, and that, you know, there's time to celebrate different things you're doing, but also there's the sad side, you know, when I've been to Iraq and seen that side of things, but for me, sort of the down times are the lonely times when you're on your own, and that sort of there are times when you have to be, or you're on your own. And those are times we're in Iraq and that, where it seems really weird, but I was sort of on a detachment to the Foreign and Commonwealth Office. But I'd actually been, before I went out there, seconded out to the embassy in Washington and that for a few years, and that with my family. So I knew the up and runnings of how it all worked. But it was the connection there between civilian and service wasn't quite there. There was only a couple of us there, and that sort of hit off each other. And that we had other services in the area. We had to go out and that to sort of be with them. And that, so, but I think my best times are sort of that. I've been on ship and that, and been with teams and that, working together.
And you mentioned family. I mean, it must be a strange life for them, having you away from home for such long periods. Is that an issue?
My wife, her father was TA and that, so she sort of knew sort of about the bits going away and things like that. But I think sort of I'm just, my daughter's 15 now, and I was in Iraq just after she was born. So sort of going away, and technology was picking up then. And when I first joined the Navy, you know, mobile phones was coming out. We're talking the bricks and that, you know, and the battery that you sort of had to put on 24 hours charge to get a 10-minute chat and that. So I think nowadays technology is a lot better than it was, and we were able to talk and sort of a video conference in that sort of, it wasn't a great deal of time, just obviously in the middle of a war zone and that. So, but there were the facilities there and that to stay in contact.
So just a little bit more about your career in the Navy, James. A lot of it will have been peacetime rather than wartime. And were you at sea? Did you serve on ships? And what sort of ships did you serve on? And what were you doing?
My first ship was HMS Coventry. That was back in the early 90s. And then, in fact, I'm going to give you a quick appraisal of my career. So I was on HMS Coventry. I then went out to join NATO in Naples for 18 months. Came back to HMS Daedalus down in Leon Solent. I then joined HMS Boxer and went out and did a couple of trips on the stateside. From there, I then went to Portsmouth for a few years. And then I went to HMS Edinburgh. Then on to HMS Ark Royal, then out to the States, out to Iraq, and then Portsmouth again. And then really my last sort of 7 years were actually in Yeovilton, and I was due to finish my time back in 2012. And then I got a few more sort of extra years on that.
And what roles were you doing? What was your main trade?
Predominantly, I was a lot of people will recognise sort of the administration and clerk and that. But that's when you join the Navy, you're first a sailor and that, and then the second role is your sort of trade and that. But you are also trained in sort of firefighting, first aid, and sort of other bits and pieces.
And there's been a lot of focus on veterans' health, and it's something that we've certainly focused on recently in Somerset. I wonder if you can explain for us why it seems that some veterans run into particularly mental health, emotional health problems. What is it about your time that you feel makes you vulnerable to that?
Well, I mean, sure, I'm quite happy to put my hand up and say that I'm one of those people. And I think it may be better now, and I'm not saying, I'm just going from my experience, and that you're very well prepared to go outside to get a job and everything like that. But I don't, at my time there, going outside, you weren't prepared for the mental side of things. You sort of mix in with, okay, I worked with civilians and that, but predominantly I had sort of, it was, you were never out sort of numbered by civilians to military, if that makes sense. And that, so going out into civilian side, and that my first job, I worked for Tesco's, and I had I was 50 drivers working for me. Now, what I found really difficult was that when I was in the military, if I asked someone to do it, they would do it, no questions. That was a part of the discipline. But what I didn't or had to sort of appreciate is that if I ask someone to do it, I may be questioned when I was in civilian street. And having 28 years of being in the military, that was sort of really sort of difficult to come to, you know, it just come from experience and that it's one of those things you had to come to terms with and that. So
you said you were one of the people affected. If you're willing to share with us, how did that affect you?
If you were military-wise and you asked someone to go and do something, they would go and do it, and it was always the way you would be asked afterwards and that, sort of a debrief and that as to why they were asked to do that. Whereas when I was in sort of civilian side in Tesco's, you would ask someone to do it and they go, well, why? Why do you want me to do that? Well, I'm asking you, but why? and that. And it was always that sort of, you know, being questioned. And then you start to doubt yourself and of what you're doing. Am I asking them the right question when they're doing it the right way? And that. And I don't know if it was the appreciation of my managers and that. I was very fortunate that they understood and that. And it was just sort of trying to get that, find the balance of coming across and that, of asking someone to do it, but in a way that they would not, they were still going to question it, but it was more from my point of view of being able to accept it. And that, and that's what I did find sort of difficult at the beginning. And also having to build a camaraderie again. It's a totally different sort of camaraderie. If you, military wise, it doesn't matter. RAF, Navy, Royal Marines, Army, that is, even though we're all different services, there's still that little bit of, you're all in the same, sorry to use that thing, you're all in the same boat, and that as such, that's what we use. And that, so there's always that little bit of camaraderie there, regardless. And that, so, but it was really hard to try and build that up again, and that completely, it's complete. Sort of attitude is not the wrong word. I think sort of understanding and in that sense.
So in a way, it sounds as though you're not saying that the Navy was a negative experience for you. It had lots of positives that were missing when you came back into civilian life.
Yeah, and, yeah, I would say that, yeah.
And I know we've talked previously on these podcasts about one of the determinants of happiness is being part of something bigger, being part of a team. And I imagine that's something that's automatic when you're in the services, is it?
Yeah, very much so, because I would say you've pretty much been all through the same, for Navy-wise, you know, you've got the ratings and the officers, and that. Ratings have got their training, officers have got their training, but you've all got the same outcome. And that, so you've still got that, the tradition. If anything, is that a lot of the military is built on tradition and that, and going through that, so it's sort of how it's built from there.
So what were the things that helped you to adjust when you came out of the services?
I'm going to be honest and say therapy more than anything. And I had to go and speak to people and stuff like that. My wife and daughter were very, very supportive and that in that sense. But unfortunately, a couple of years ago or down the line, I was involved in a serious car accident and that, but it sort of tipped me over the edge, if I can say that. And I sort of went backwards more than anything in that sense.
And I can imagine from the people I know who've been in the forces, there's very much a get on with it attitude. So was it difficult for you to accept that therapy was something that you needed? Did that go against the grain of your...
Yeah, I think I did. It's where you said about getting on with it. It's very much pride and that, you know, you can have been on board ship and things like that, and you've been in a, you know, you've had a long day, you've been up since like 5 o'clock in the morning and that, and there's still things to do and that. And it comes down to personal pride and that, and being a part of a team like I say, getting on with it, because you're all in there together and you're sort of getting on with it and that regardless.
So accepting that you need therapy must dent that pride, does it?
Oh, it was horrendous. When I, obviously you'll know the process and that, what to go through and that. And I'd always had some anxiety, and that, and I'd learned to grow up with it and cracked on and that. But to be told that you're depressed as well and that, and I was like, no, I can't be. And that, and that can send you down the sort of the wrong way as well, and that, you know, that being in denial and that, and you think, well, what am I doing wrong?
Interesting. That's a really helpful story, James. Now, something that you'll be able to help us on is the Armed Services or the Armed Forces Covenant, which is a promise from the nation to anybody who has served or is serving that they'll be treated fairly and not disadvantaged. And I think there's an Armed Forces Services Bill coming out at the moment, which puts a requirement on NHS and local government to make sure that appropriate housing, school places and healthcare is provided. What do you know about what's going to come along? Because there are some things, and I think Peter may be able to help us as well on this, because I think Somerset's got a particular interest in this.
I think from what I've gathered, there's been a few things going on behind in the background anyway with the NHS, and that there's always been that sort of link there anyway. And I think it's just providing more support and that in, I think it's putting it in concrete more than anything and that, and to give sort of the armed forces and the NHS support for themselves and that, and if they can work with each other with a bit more guidance from each other.
You're absolutely right, and you've already articulated one of the barriers, which is pride and shame that many of us have to accessing. But there are 9 commitments on the covenant, and that is, and we're applying them in Somerset, and we've got a programme of work to look forward to this. And if you don't mind me sharing the 9 commitments, the first one is to work in partnership to commission safe, high quality care for serving personnel and their families, and then, you know, we've got a good number of servicemen in Somerset supporting families, carers, children and young people in the armed forces community. And then 3 is helping the transition from the armed forces to civilian life. And I know that maybe in your last few months, whilst you were serving, is there some sort of resettlement and adjustment support?
It's up to 2 years, sort of building you, sort of training you can do and courses you can go on and that. But from sort of my experience, I say when I left, nothing, you know, you need to prepare yourself and that you could potentially have some dark days and that where things aren't going to go right for you and that. You get told about all the different charities and that there and that, but not, potentially what, you could go through.
So there's some preparation in terms of tasks and abilities, but when it comes to the psychological issue, it's quite difficult because at the point we leave an organisation or a family that we've been involved with for a long time, it is like a bereavement. And so we go through loss and we go through shock and denial and maybe anger and guilt and certainly depression before we reach acceptance. The fourth one is identifying and supporting armed forces veterans. And the fifth one, which we're talking about a bit today, and thank you very much for all the colour you've given us so far, is improving veterans and their families' mental health. And there are some others about inequalities and data and technology and research and innovation. So there's some things there. Peter, would you like to pick up on some of those?
I think, yes. I mean, for me, words are great, aren't they? And we can have the best protocols in the world. It's putting it into action that really is something that I was going to say floats my boat. Perhaps that's an appropriate naval saying, is it, James?
Perfect, perfect. Absolutely perfect.
And certainly in practice, the organisation I see that is incredibly supportive is the British Legion. Is that Royal British Legion? Is that something you've had contact with, James?
I haven't, no. Not the British Legion. I've used, in fact, I've been a part of the, or had support from speech therapy, Somerset Talking Therapies, and that had been very, very supportive, and that when I was going through some bad times. The Royal British Legion, I mean, say only from some people I know that have done some work with them and that, and from what I've heard and that, they're really good, really, really, really good. And there are other charities out there and that as well that can offer support.
There's combat stress and SAFR. But I think, Peter, you're very much involved with Open Mental Health, which we want to have as a front door to help people.
Absolutely. This is something that I'm very proud that we pioneered in Somerset. So we were one of the trailblazer mental health trusts. And we very much have this idea of no wrong door, as you say, open mental health. So there's not this split into primary and secondary care. And certainly a big part of that is talking therapists. And you've mentioned, James, Somerset talking therapists. Anybody, whether a veteran or anyone else, can self-refer. They don't need to go through their GP. If they just Google Somerset talking therapist, they'll find their webpage. There are lots of very useful little leaflets on how to deal with common mental health problems. And they can self-refer to talking therapists and get the sort of counselling that you found helpful yourself. So I'd encourage anyone who feels they might benefit from it to overcome any reluctance they've got and just get in touch with Somerset talking therapist. And just to add nicer in the middle, they're bringing out new guidelines on depression, and very much they're stressing that the first line treatment for depression should be talking therapies of one sort or another.
And Peter, how do we access open mental health in Somerset? You've mentioned online Somerset talking therapies, but is it Mind in Somerset or...?
There's Mindline, so we often give this a plug, don't we, Andrew? So you probably have got the phone number at your fingertips, but again, if you just Google Somerset Mindline, that's a 24-hour service, and they can refer you on, or you can go through your GP, and every, as part of the improvements we've made in Somerset, every surgery now should have access to a dedicated mental health support worker.
01823 276 892 24/7. So there we are. That's Somerset Mindline, 01823 276 892. And that's the front door for open mental health.
And did you find the talking therapists, once you'd overcome that reluctance, James, were they judgmental? Was it challenging? Did you find it hard to overcome that sort of stiff upper lip that had been drilled into you?
No, not at all. I mean, say personally, and I've always been sort of upfront with anything, and even when I was going through my mental health issues, and once I sort of got over that initial thing, I wanted as many people to know that I was suffering in a way, not for my own good or anything like that, but to know that what I was going through, if it got someone else, even just one person, to make that call or to speak to someone else, and that then I knew the message was getting out, and that to people.
And certainly I would always say to patients, often they'll come to me saying, well, I feel anxious or depressed or whatever because of my situation, and that's something that I can't change. And my response would be, no, you may not be able to change the situation, though sometimes you can, but you can always change the way you react to it and respond to it. And that's something that talking therapists is very good. It's encouraging, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, so something I pretty much sort of learned really more now is it's just to, even in the office, when you're in office and you're sort of getting to the point of, you know, I'm just about to, it's just to get up and walk away and just go and get outside, get some fresh air, go and get a, you know, a cup of tea or something like that. You know, these people that work in front of computers and on telephones and that, sometimes they're stuck in front of them and they just need to, you know, get away and that. But that's sort of support they need from managers and that as well, and that, and from organisations and that, just to let people just sort of get up and get, you know, and but also for people to speak to their managers and speak to their organisations and that, and people would be surprised and that how much support is out there for people.
Thank you, James. And I think you've moved from one very big organisation, the Royal Navy, into one rather small organisation, but for Somerset, a very big organisation, which is the NHS and Yeovil District Hospital. And I would imagine is it good to be part of a team there?
Oh, yeah. It's like being in a family. And that. In fact, I don't see the hospital. I see it as a ship and that, because you've got your CEO's the captain, and then you've got all your different departments and things like that. So it's in that sort of sense, it's like being back home again in that, and that, and the camaraderie's there as well. And that, you know, when you go round and you see different people different days, and I know it's a lot harder now with COVID and things like that, but I've come in sort of into the thick of things. But, you know, even just to sort of notice people, say hello to people, and that, you know, it's really, really nice.
And I think you've given us some incredibly helpful tips for both for veterans and for anyone else around try and be part of a team and feel that camaraderie and make the most of it. Try and get out into nature wherever possible, not spend all day sat in front of a screen, and be willing to seek help and actually accept that talking therapies and changing the way you look at things can actually make a difference and turn things around.
Absolutely. James, thank you very much indeed for coming along and joining us today. Is there any last word you'd like to say? I love your analogy of the hospital being like a ship. Is there anything else you'd like to share with us?
No, I'd just like to say thank you very much for inviting me on today.
Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, James.
Thank you.
Bye for now.
You've been listening to the Somerset Emotional Wellbeing Podcast, hosted by Dr. Andrew Tresida and Dr. Peter Bagshaw. The show was created by David Seeley and was produced by Rob Huns Music on behalf of the Somerset Clinical Commissioning Group.